This recording is brought to you by listenupnorth.com.
Wendy Robertson reads from the beginning of her novel, Sandy Shaw and the Millionth Marvel Cooker.
Notes on a Time and a Place. I will tell you a story of a factory, a very special place. It was a long time ago, but for me, it's just as though it were yesterday. We're in the mid-1960s, the last age of post-war innocence, the dawn of the age of celebrity. The town of Grafton, once built around coal, now relies on Marvel domestic appliances for its income and prosperity. This big factory employs 2,500 workers, mostly women, who support 80% of the households in the town. Some of these women are third-generation workers, their mothers and grandmothers having worked on the Marvel site in the Second World War to assist in the making of bombs to drop on Hitler. The week I start at Marvel's, the tannoy is blaring out Sandy Shaw's There's Always Something There to Remind Me, instead of Can't Buy Me Love and I Want to Hold Your Hand. This is much to the disgust of younger workers who think their taste is far more sophisticated than this. After all, the Beatles, the Rolling Stones are where it's at these days. My tale of Sandy Shaw's visit to Marvel's is only one of many stories told and untold that fused together to make those 10 days in the mid-60s so very extraordinary. Early start, Monday. On the day I started at Marvel's, I sat beside my mother on the early bus, which smelt of soap and freshly lit cigarettes, as it swayed and bumped through a morning that seemed bruised and battered from the night before. The bus was packed to an illegal level, too many bodies crowded together. The faces shone out and receded in the pallid early morning light. There was no talk, no eye contact at this time of day. People just smoked and coughed, scanned the papers, picked horses, read horoscopes, and checked on last night's football score. Some girls, cigarettes in mouths, were taking out their big rollers and putting on full makeup. One girl was clipping on large daisy earrings. At the factory gates, the stream of workers flowing from the dozens of buses merged into a river of people pouring down the walkway towards the flat grey hangar-like building that encompassed the great Marvel Enterprise. I had to stop to take it all in. Of course I'd heard about this place from my mother, and I'd seen it many times from the bus on the main road. But up close, it was another thing, bigger and dustier, kind of seething with some life of its own. "Come on, Cassie." My mother nudged my arm and led me through a door at the side. While we stood in the queue waiting for her to clock in, I blinked around at the inside of the building and caught my breath. The building was twice as big as it seemed outside. The long production lines stretched into the distance. Overhead wires looped down like so many spiders' webs. No machine sounds, just the echo of voices as hundreds of people trickled towards their stations, muttering, laughing, dumping out their cigarettes. My mother grabbed my arm again and marched me down the line till we came to a crossroads. "This is me," she said, "and that's you." She pointed towards a kind of watchtower of offices in the centre of the building, overlooking the lines. An iron staircase led up to a gantry with doors leading off it. "Up those stairs, love. There he is. You can't miss Charlie Priest. The smooth bloke that's wearing a suit. Tell him I sent you. He knows you're coming." She strode off then, like she owned the place. I ran up the stairs under the eyes of Mr. Priest. He had shaving cuts on his face and smelled strongly of aftershave. "I'm Cassandra Fox," I said. "I was told to come here." "Linda's gal. Good worker, our Linda." He had this funny voice, not quite American. He looked me over. I saw myself reflected in his eyes. A girl of 19, nearly as tall as he was. Neat figure, nice legs. Mousy hair swept back too hard in a ponytail, making the face longer and thinner. Even then, I knew my good points and my bad. I stared back at him defiantly. "Let's get you started, then." He led the way through an office where two women were already typing. One, a fair, slender woman, really good-looking, looked up and smiled with faint sympathy. In the corner, a man in a ragged, spotless white coat was staring up at a notice board. And beside him, a young man in shirt and tie squeezed his eyes against the smoke of his cigarette as he ticked off columns in a ledger in front of him. He raised his head and his eyes flickered over me, just like Mr. Priest's had. But I was not offended this time. This one was good-looking, not in a film starish way, but in a tight, pale-skinned, high-cheek-boned, grey-eyed kind of way. I have to tell you, my heart lurched, but I was only 19 then, still a virgin, and unspoken for, so my heart tended to lurch with alarming regularity. In his office, Mr. Priest sat down behind a desk piled with papers and files and bristling with offcuts of metal. He nodded at the chair opposite, and I sat down. Then he lit a cigar, took a good drag, and filled in some forms. "Here, sign this, Cassandra Fox," he said. He signed a time card and pushed it across to me. "I've marked it up for you this morning, but don't you forget to clock out tonight on the machine. The girls will show you how, and don't forget to clock in tomorrow. Remember," he drawled, "not clocked in, not clocked off, not paid." On the gantry, we looked down at the long production lines, and the sheer noise hit my ears. The women were working away, some of them shouting over the noise of the tannoy, blaring out summertime blues, their raucous tones counterpointing the smooth tones of Eddie Cochran. The penetrating voices and the straining music were underpinned by the humming grind of the conveyor belt. "I'm sending you down on the wiring jackets, Cassandra. Nice little job. There are good workers there, and they'll show you the job," said Priest. He leaned over the railing of the gantry and bawled, "Steve!" A young man looked up from the box of wires he was loading onto the end of the line from a trolley. He was a little too fat, but had smooth mushroom-coloured hair and was very neat, wearing a shirt and tie and pressed slacks, not overalls, like some of the other boys I had seen when I came in. "Yes, Mr. Priest," he said. "Take this young woman down to the wiring and set her on with Patsy O'Hare. I'll let Stan Laverick know. I want her there. Name of Cassandra Fox, Linda's girl." The boy's keen glance moved to me and he grinned. His eyes stayed on my face. At least he didn't look me up and down. "Yeah, boss," he says. I looked down from the gantry, glued to the spot. The place had this funny smell of dust and powder and concrete, of burnt paint and industrial grease, of bodies and cigarette smoke. Priest laughed. "Daniel into the lion's den, eh?" He gave my shoulder a push. "Get on then, young lady. You've got to start sometime, somewhere. Linda tells me you're a clever sort, but down there is the real world where clever counts different. Down there we work. We know how many beans make five. Another kind of education, you could say." I took a deep breath and made my way down the iron stairs. I'd said 9 words to Priest, and now it seemed I was part of the machine, part of his operation. Ouch! I licked my finger and dropped the wires again. The woman called Patsy O'Hare, narrow face, grey-blonde hair piled high on her head, pouchy cheeks, too much lipstick. She didn't stop working. "Not doing too well, are we? Cassandra, was it?" There was no sympathy in her voice. "From where I sit, looks like you've got 2 left hands, pet." Her voice was deep as a man's, but resonant, not hard to listen to. I stared at the bench in front of me. The boy called Steve had showed me the job. Screw 2 little screw holders into a kind of wiring harness with small screws. Once you'd done that, the slowly moving line took it to the next girl, who bunched the dozens of wires and, hands flying, screwed them into the harness. Steve introduced this girl to me as Karen. Her glossy black hair fell onto her shoulders, and she wore a long fringe set in 2 maxi rollers. Her eyes were lined in coal. Even with rollers, she had glamour. "Seezy," Karen went over it again after Steve had left. "You just do this, and this, and this." That word just. The job wasn't easy. It cut your fingers till they bled, and my fingers, quick as they were with pen and paper, were very slow. I struggled on for half an hour under the eyes of these two women, and at last Karen sighed, jumped off her stool, and came to stand by me. "You want a bit of help, love?" Her words were friendlier than her tone. "You're stopping the line here." I rubbed my eyes with my sore hands and said a very humble thank you. Karen slipped into my seat and demolished my backlog of work, her hands whirring to the point of invisibility. Watching her steady, machine-like movements, my eyes swam and my body dropped into a throb that fell into the rhythm with the music on the tannoy. Bye, bye, love. Talk about dated. Karen jumped up again and I thanked her too enthusiastically. Patsy O'Hare looked up, not stopping her wiring. "No need to say thank you, Flower. Our Karen just doesn't want you to stop the line and lose us all our bonus. Looking after number one like we all have to." I picked up the wires and screwdriver. "It's not fair to expect me to be quick straight away. It's not my real job." God, what a whiner I sounded. "Not a real job. Ooh, I forgot. Student, aren't you? Should have known. Fancy name you've got. No job at all, this, for someone called Cassandra," said Patsy. "You're lucky to get a job at all just here for the summer," said Karen. "Must know somebody." I nodded. "My mother works down on circuit breakers." "What's she called?"
Linda Fox.
"I know her. Marvel's bloody marvellous family policy," growled Patsy. "Landed us with more duck eggs than the naffy omelette. I can't help it if... Oof, ouch! This wire's like knives. Doesn't half cut you." I got down to scrabble on the floor for the drop wires. When I got back to my stool, Karen lifted her open hand in the air, fingers splayed. "What you need is plasters, love. One for every finger. Prevention better than cure." I put down my screwdriver and looked around. So where'd you get the plasters?"
"Whoa! Matter of fact, you can get the plasters from the woman who takes care of the lass," said Patty.
"But stop where you are for now, Flower. Don't want you stopping the line altogether." So, ignoring my singing fingers, I picked up my screwdriver, got my head down and worked on, avoiding the gaze of the other two women and only half listening to their talk about Elvis and Priscilla and the wonderful romance of it all. Every so often, Karen would come round silently to help me with my backlog, but nothing was said. After what seemed like many hours, the 9 o'clock buzzer went. First break, I could have cried with gratitude. This time last week, I was rolling in for my first lecture, already sleepy from my college breakfast. As the conveyor ground to a halt, the rippling sound of talk filled the workshop like the twittering of starlings in the hangar-like space. I knew from my mother that this 10-minute breathing space in the factory, secrets were spread, reputations and marriages were made and ruined. Patsy brought a stool round to sit beside Karen, who smiled and lounged back, her flask of coffee in one hand and a cucumber in the other. She took a bite of the cucumber as though it were an apple. She looked at me. "Don't you like it in here, then?" she asked. "Cassandra?" She said my name like it was a joke. I shrugged. "I've just started. What do I know?" Patsy laughed. "Doesn't need to bother to like it. Cassandra here will be back away, shot of us all in a few weeks' time." "Nice name, that. Where might that come from?" "I was called after that man that writes in the Daily Mirror." "I read his stuff," said Patsy. "He said they shouldn't hang Ruth Ellis. Years ago. Right, too. He was talking sense. Bloody men." Karen bit into her cucumber. "It's a man's name, then?" "No, it's after a Greek goddess who foretold the future." "I'll tell you my future," said Patsy. "Work, work, and more bloody work." That seemed unanswerable. "You've got a boyfriend, then?" said Karen, closing a sandwich box and putting it into her bag. "Well, I know some boys." One of the nice things about college is the possibility of being friends,
not just with the girls there, but with the boys from the university down the road. Equality and independence is the thing these days. Everyone seems to keep their options open. Only a few of the girls have begun to pair off. Just now, that really suits me. "Aye, them college lads," says Patsy. "I heard about 'em. Get up to all sorts, don't you? Sex and drugs and rock and roll, isn't it?" "Not for all of us," I said primly. "Not all the time," I added in my head. "Nearly choking yourself on a joint or two doesn't count as drugs. One of the boys had taken LSD and said it was amazing, but he had none the day we met him, so we couldn't try it." Patsy folded her arms, pressing her breasts high, like a pouter pigeon. "Don't get me wrong, Flower. Me, I like a good time, don't we all? You're a short time on this earth, I say." Then suddenly the tenor blared out with Sandy Shaw singing, "There's always something there to remind me." A cheer went down the line and a few of the women started to sing along. Karen jumped down from the stool and started to sway and dance to the music. The boy called Steve brought his coffee and leaned on the end of the line to get a better view. Then the record finished and she stopped dancing. Another cheer erupted from the line opposite and Steve put his fingers in his mouth and whistled. Karen jumped back onto her stool, breathing hard. "I tell you what, I can't believe she's really coming here to this place, to Marvel's. That Sandy, just think. It says in the newspaper she's just waiting for another big hit like that one." Karen took out her rollers and combed her fringe down over her eyes with her fingers. She took a mirror from her pocket and peered at herself. Steve grinned at her. "A blind man on a fleeing horse might think you look like Sandy, Karen, except for one thing." She pouted, and what might that be? He pointed downwards. "You've got your shoes on." "Oh, very funny. Do you think anybody'd leave their shoes off on this filthy floor?" "She might. Charlie Priest's ordering this big clean-up for when she comes, so they say." The buzzer went again and the conveyor started to whine. Steve gathered his empty trolley and went off whistling, "There's always something there to remind me." Patsy went back round her side of the line and Karen rewound the two giant rollers. "Oh, it'll be good to see Sandy in the flesh, though," she said. "I can't believe she really is coming, you know. It was in the papers. What about that, Patsy? Sandy is really coming here. I can't believe it." Patsy glanced at me and rolled her eyes. I picked up my wires and my screwdriver, my heart heavy again. I had forgotten about the plasters. No time to get them now. Patsy picked up a bunch of wires and her hands started to fly. "I tell you what, Karen, when that Sandy sees you, she'll think you're making game. You really are her spitting image." Karen tossed back her hair, not displeased. Patsy's hands dropped into their rhythm. "How about it, though? Millionth cooker. Millionth bloody cooker. Who are they kidding? I might have turned a million wires for them, but I've never seen parts for a million cookers going down the line, I'm telling you." Karen's hands were flying over the wires. "Don't you think we've made a million then, Patsy?" You're out of the egg, lass. Have you any idea what a million is? It's a lot. Well, pet, you go out on the darkest, clearest night and look at those bloody stars. See them? A million's twice, thrice as many as the stars you see there. Have we made that many cookers? That's a joke. As at last I began to drop into a rhythm of my own, screwing those wires, it occurred to me that Patsy O'Hare was not so stupid. Not stupid at all.
That was Wendy Robertson reading from her book Sandy Shaw and the Millionth Marvel Cooker, published by Headline. The recording was directed and produced by Rachel Cochrane, with sound recording and editing by David Ainsley at Core Music Hexham.